Before I introduce our speaker here, I want to just tell you a little story, and also for our new friends here to show you how this thing works. I became involved with Alcoholics Anonymous back in 1948. Worked with alcoholics all the way through, came to California, became part of the National Council in 1960. I was not an alcoholic. I chased our speaker around the circuits, Norm Elpy and Chuck C. and various other ones, and I finally got here as an alcoholic in 1971. So you see, the program does work. In Alabama, I knew her when I wasn't an alcoholic yet. Alabama.
Good evening, fellow alcoholics and friends. My name is Alabama Carruthers, and I'm a grateful, happy alcoholic. Amen. I'm glad to be here, but I say that everywhere I go, because I'm glad to be alive. I'm glad to be sober. I'm glad to be here where I was invited to come. And tomorrow I'm going to be glad to know where I've been. And that shows you the change that has taken place in my life since I got sober. Quite often I awakened and didn't know where I was until I read the stationery in the hotel. You know, that was sort of a pattern at the end. I was just sitting over there thinking, one of the subjects that's going to be used at the Montreal convention, I have a 50th convention this year, is the disease. It's not contagious, but the recovery is. And I just think that's great. I think it's great. And then that reminds me of Phil G. from the North Hollywood group. Some of you remember him. He came in, and his sponsor got him some coffee in one of, in those days we had real cups, and brought it to him. And Phil said, "I don't want to drink out of that cup." His sponsor looked at him and said, "Phil, you can't get it. You already got it." I've always loved that. And when I saw this title of the of this Alcathon, I just thought it was just so great. The recovery certainly is contagious. I was too sick when I got here to stay to read the book. And this is so important. Just so important, but my eyes wouldn't focus. So I had to watch what people did, the people who were sober did, and just emulate them, because I couldn't read what this said, and they didn't read it at the meetings when I first came in. And that was in Missouri that I came in to stay. I'd come in not to stay in California, Missouri, and New York. I just came to appease the people in my life, and with no desire to stop drinking. I really did want to learn how to control it. And you didn't know how, and I was just disgusted. Because I had no intent to quit. You know, that was the furthest from my mind. God was so good to me. Even as sick as I was, I seemingly knew the people that had the happy kind of AA program that I wanted. And I evidently was right even then, because the four of them died sober. And not only did they die sober, but they were the people that went to the prisons to speak. They were the people that would go anywhere. And sometimes our meetings didn't have over 8 or 10 people in those days, especially back in the smaller towns in Missouri. They'd go anywhere and they'd speak. And see, we didn't have comp care and all of those places for alcoholics to go then. And we would call on the people in their homes, and we would take care of them through the night. And we'd sit through the night with them, and sometimes we'd have to do this for quite a few nights running. And these were the kind of people that I tried to emulate. These were the kind of people that I wanted to be like. And I just thank God that I'm sure that I didn't choose these people. I bragged about what wonderful sponsors I had for a long time, thinking that I had picked them out. I didn't have that much judgment then. They picked me out. because they saw how sick I was, and they wanted to try to help me. I'm sure that's what happened. Not only did I just want to emulate them in the recovery, but this book, of course, and everything that I have done in trying to work these steps has been, brought about my recovery. But you new people don't realize how important, and the people that we are allowed to try to sponsor, how important you are in our recovery. I learn more from you when you're telling me about you than I ever learned just from reading. Just reading how to take the fourth and fifth step. I thought that I had taken a very good fifth step, fourth and fifth step, and I have never listened or read anybody's inventory that something didn't come up in that inventory that reminded me of me. And I'd say, would you please stop? I'd love to tell you this about me. And because it saves me writing it. I'm not one of those people that take more than one inventory. The 10th step does it for me. I just pick it up in the 10th step. I think it would be an ego trip for me to write every year about me. I really think so. And God knows I don't need that. I drank for 23 years. To make the drinking short, I will try to tell you, the best I can, I had a love affair with alcohol. I started playing with it at 16. That was puppy love. By the age of 19, I'm really interested. And by the age of 28, I'm a chronic alcoholic. And I don't know when I went into acute alcoholism. I know a couple of years before I quit drinking that a doctor wrote acute alcoholism on my chart. And that was at St. John Psycho in Santa Monica. I used to think I was better than people. Oh, I forgot to tell you, it jilted me. My love jilted me. But I was so sick when I was jilted, I didn't know I'd been jilted. It just kept telling me it was going to take me where it used to. And it was going to do for me what it used to do for me. And I'd been sober quite a little while before I figured out alcohol can't talk. I carried on long conversations with it. I blamed all of that stinking thinking on the alcohol. Especially, you know, when I was thinking about killing somebody, if I could figure out a way I wouldn't get caught. And I give you my word of honor, I can't remember her name now. So I guess I have forgiven her for whatever she did to me, I did to her. And this is just only when I was drunk would I think like that, because I could blame it on the alcohol. And then after I'd been sober a while, I realized alcohol can't think. But I was certain that a nice woman like me wouldn't have done those things I did, except for being drunk. So surely the whiskey made me do it. And then I found out that alcohol can't act. And where did that leave me? It left me responsible for everything that I thought, said, and had done. And I didn't like it. I didn't like it. And it was hard for me to forgive myself. But my sponsor, Walt, told me that I didn't have any right not to forgive myself. That God hadn't brought me that far not to have forgiven me. And that it would be an insult to him not to accept his forgiveness. That was one of the first freedoms that came in my life, to accept the forgiveness for what I had done in the past. And if you see me moping around and in trouble, it has nothing to do with the past. It would be because I felt guilty about something I had just done now. Because my past is only used for reference, so that I won't do the same thing again, and so that I can tell you about it and you might be able to identify as an alcoholic, because I am able to identify as an alcoholic. I went to my first meeting at North Hollywood, and that's my home group, and I think it's the finest group in the world, but I sure didn't like it that night. For those of you who haven't been there, it's in a little place that looks like a church. And all I could think of is hellfire and damnation and revival meetings, and that if you dance with a man you weren't married to or drank whiskey or played cards or smoked cigarettes, you'd go to hell. And I was already there, if those things counted. And I just thought that's the kind of thing they were going to talk about. Then I got in it, and you had all of these little things around on the wall, like first things first, but I was shocked. I knew first things first meant you had to get the bottle before you could drink it. And I had already stopped from the Dr. Shara Sanitarium on the way over to the North Hollywood Club and gotten me a bottle, and had already made the trip before I saw that to the bathroom. And I went to the bathroom a lot that night. I don't have to go so often now. But it was that's the only way I could have stayed, I think, at the meeting. And we have on the overhang, we have a sign that says, "We Care." And it's all lit up, but in those days, it flashed on and off. Now, people thought that I was hallucinating, but I wasn't, because the man that put it up there said it had Christmas tree lights in it at the time that I came the first time to North Hollywood. And I thought, who in the hell cares whether a drunk cares or not? And if you hadn't cared over these last 32 years and some months, I wouldn't be here. Because without you, I wouldn't have been here. You have made it possible for me to stay and to stay sober, because you give of what you find to me, and we in turn give it to each other. And I've been able so far, with the help of this program, to stay happily sober for over 32 years, and I'm impressed. I'm impressed what God and Alcoholics Anonymous can do for me that I couldn't do for myself. Because I tried everything but not drinking. That was too drastic. I've been to hospitals all over the country. I was in Dr. Shara's when I went to my first AA meeting. And Arvel C., you real old-timers would remember him. He died sober. He took me to the meeting. He didn't want to stop, but I wouldn't go without the bottle. And then you had signs like "Think, think, think." I don't really believe they belong where newcomers could see it. My sponsors told me that didn't apply to me. That they do my thinking until I was able to think. And see, the reason I think that it's sort of dangerous, I don't know about you, but the one reason I said to me that I drank so much was that I couldn't turn my head off at night. When I'd go to bed to go to sleep, I couldn't turn my head off. All that guilt and shame and degradation was coming in, and I couldn't turn it off. And so I wondered, didn't you know that's why I drank so much? Because I thought so much. But now I can lay my head down on the pillow and go to sleep. And I'm grateful for that. That's one of the big fringe benefits for me. I think nearly everybody I know that came into AA had insomnia. I call myself drinking enough to sleep at night. But what I actually did, I drank enough to pass out at night. But I never called things by their right names anyhow until I got sober. You know, just didn't. I always wanted it to sound better so it wouldn't bother me. But again that night, I saw this first. I told you that, though. I saw Easy Does It on the wall. And we painted not too long ago. I left most of those things down, but it's just because I hadn't had time to put them up. That just reminded me of it. But that Easy Does It. When you got here, did you think anything had ever been done easy? I did everything the hard way. Everything the hard way. And it just, if it wasn't, I had to go out of my way to find the hard way. But I could manage. I managed to do it the hard way. There were several things I didn't like about that meeting. One man got up and said he'd been in Lincoln Heights, and people laughed, and I didn't know what Lincoln Heights was, and I punched Arvel. I thought maybe it was a men's club. I didn't live out here. I came from Nevada over here to get sober. My husband wanted me out of town, so everybody didn't know his wife was a drunk. And I would fly into Burbank, and he'd call a cab to meet me there and to take me to showers dry until I got to where I went to Psycho at St. John's. But so I punched him, and he said it was the big jail facility downtown. And I thought, well, I wouldn't have told it if I'd been there. It didn't bother me a bit they'd been there. And then, though, folks, I was so ashamed for the next man that got up after that. That man stood there and said he had been in a federal penitentiary. And I thought, oh, my God, doesn't he know you don't tell this at a social gathering? And I wasn't shocked that he'd been there. It was just that he would tell it. You know, just that's how phony I was when I came in. And so I'll have to hurry this talk along because you can't tell about 72 years, you know, in 50 minutes or 45. And that's exactly how long it is for me. But it was in April. But I was to marry a man after I'd been sober a year. Two and a half years. I was to marry a man, a prince of a man. And he had been in a federal penitentiary. And he got there for doing the very same things that I had done. And that this man did that was up there talking that night. He wrote big bad checks. And I did too. But my father covered mine. My husband in his lifetime covered my checks. Then my father, then my brothers. Then the Al-Anons got to him and told them about what they were doing wrong. And they quit covering them. And I said one time, just to try to make them jealous, to one of the women, one of your husbands may have covered my checks after that because I never had to pay the price, you know. But Jim, it was different with Jim. His wife divorced him. She just couldn't take care of his debts. Jim and I both thought the best was not good enough for us, you understand, so we wrote big ones. And Jim's mother went bankrupt trying to keep him out of prison. And then the banks cut off Jim's account. Mine never got cut off. And Jim had to use other people's bank accounts. And which he did for, you know. And so he got put in for a short time. Jim and I were married a year and a week. And Jim was killed in an automobile accident. We were living in Bakersfield at the time. And I couldn't have made it through. I just plain couldn't have made it through. But we did. You and God and I got through it, sober. My father died 2 months before. My father died 2 months after I had gotten sober. I couldn't have gone through that because he was my rock of Gibraltar after my husband had died a year before I got sober. My first husband, that is. And you were with me day and night as long as I needed you. And then since I've been sober, I lost a sister and brother from alcoholism. And you walked through that with me. And you walked through the death of my mother and my couple of other brothers and many loved ones. And as I said, I couldn't have done it without you. I've been asked to tell about how I was after Jim was killed. After about 2 weeks in the state of shock had left me, I went to a meeting, and I guess that when I talk, that they heard a great deal of poor me, poor me, poor me. And one of the boys said, Alabama, if you don't quit the poor me, it's going to be poor me a drink. And they said, are you eating solid food yet? And I said, no. There were two of them that attacked me on that subject. And I said, no, I can't swallow it. And the doctor's giving me everything I need in liquids. And they said, well, we're going to take you out for dinner. We're going to a place that's open all night. And you go eat a steak and a baked potato and a salad before we take you home. And if we go do everything but chew it for you, if necessary, we'll cut it in tiny bits and spoon feed you, if that's what it takes. But you go eat tonight. We got home, I ate. We got home, and these two men told me if I was uncomfortable in my meeting clothes to go change, that they were going to be there a while. They had some things to talk about. And they told me that I ought to be on my knees every day thanking God for what Jim and I had for a year and a week. That neither of the two of them had ever had a relationship like that. And that they might never have a relationship like that. And it was the best relationship they had ever seen between two alcoholics. And they said, aren't you grateful that you had it? And I said, yes. And then said, then why aren't you thanking God that you had it? That you had it. You've got memories that we'll never, maybe never have. Those men stayed all night long talking to me, telling me if I didn't get out of self and start being of service to other people and working with some new girls, that I was going to be in trouble, and real trouble. And I was so grateful, because when they left, I had just changed all of my attitude and it for the better. And I thought nothing of it. It was daylight, 7 o'clock, and the neighbors were leaving. It was in Bakersfield, too, and that's not like Hollywood. They were leaving to go to work. I walked out in my robe with both of these men and hugged and kissed both of them and then realized that my neighbors are watching and I didn't give a damn. That was freedom to me, for me. Freedom. It had never had been quite so important what I did as what you saw me do. You know, or what you heard that I did. I just thought, God, that's real freedom. Freedom that I know what I did last night, and the men know what they did last night, and I don't care what the neighbors think. And that's real freedom, because it used to be so important what you thought. I like for people to think well of me, but if they don't, that's their problem. That's their problem. I think well of me. Not that I'm perfect and that I work this program to the best of my intellectual ability, but because I'm doing the best that I can with what I got to work with today. My emotions enter into how well I work the program too. And this is the best I've ever been, and I'm not going to beat myself about it, you know. But anyhow, I've been in so many hospitals, I can't tell you when and where, all over the country, from one end of the United States to the other. As I said, we didn't have the Comcast and hospitals like that. I was in on false diagnoses. I diagnosed my case from listening to other people who had been very ill, and then called the doctor and give them the symptoms, because I knew that I was going to die if I didn't get in the hospital. I would go into alcoholic pneumonia. I still have bronchial problems. I mean, even though I'm not smoking now, after 53 years, I quit smoking. You know, 23 years I quit drinking, and 53 years I quit smoking. And I'm impressed at that, too. I really am. I prayed for the willingness. I prayed for the willingness to quit. And God and hiptonness did the rest. So I have a feeling that I got to put God first, because I just had 4 sessions with her, and I have one with God every day, maybe several times a day. Not about that, because I'm not really having any trouble with it. I just want to eat everything in sight. But I just get lost, and my family couldn't find me. There have been times when my husband, I love my husband, and the things that I did had nothing to do with my love for him. He became a chronic gambler, and I didn't know it. I didn't know it. I thought he gambled like I did, because I didn't stand over the table to see how much he lost or won. And I thought he gambled like I did, and I found myself in far worse condition. In fact, the chairman of the board had told me when he died that if I had nothing but my stock in that company, I'd be fixed for life. And I would have, because it went to 100 and split. But I didn't have it because he had borrowed to the hilt on it, and I had to sell nearly all of it to keep any of it. I was a good wife when I was sober enough. I did crazy things drunk, like I'd been hostess for the company, and I liked it. Now, I was married to a mining engineer, and I could travel with him to San Francisco and New York for the board meetings and all of these kind of things. And I had a chauffeur, but that really wasn't for status symbol. That was so I would get back the same day with the car and so forth. I had everything furnished me when I was a company hostess, and things went well for years. Not that I wasn't having a problem with drinking, but I watched where I drank too much. But one night I didn't watch it. The chairman of the board of directors asked me to put a party together for the directors that he was bringing down. And they were the ones that had the most stock. And they were men that were in Who's Who, and, you know, I'd read about them in Wall Street Journal. And I was the only woman at the party, and it was at a nice club in North Carolina, and I told the chairman of the board some little silly joke about the devaluation of the American dollar. And that man said, where everybody at the table could hear him, "Evelyn," that's my real name, "Evelyn, I didn't know you had communistic ideas." Well, you don't say that to a drunken rebel. I'm not even sure you'd better say it to a sober rebel. And I stood up so my voice would carry. And I pointed my finger at him and called him a son of a bitch. My husband had never heard me swear. I'd used that word once when I was 5. And I didn't know what it meant and had my mouth washed out for it. And I knew what it meant when I called him one. And I told him that my family was making this a safe democracy when his family was trying to get steerage together. And it was the truth. It was the truth. And my husband was going to quit the job, and I told him I would rather leave him than him quit the job, because he was well known in the mining field, and the word travels fast when you got a drunken wife. Because in the larger companies, they interview the wives, too, as well as the husbands for the jobs, such as my husband had. And he said, no. And I said, but I am going to. And when we got home, I said, I pulled the trunk out of my pack. And I really did try to. I kept drinking at the party. I asked somebody to just slug me when they were pouring my drink, that I didn't want to know where I was and who I was with. You know, I did anything that I was could be insulting. I said it that evening before we left. And I didn't have much luck with the packing. I called myself folding and putting them in the trunk. But what I was doing, I wadded the clothes. And I fell in on top of them when I'd reached down to put them in the trunk. And I looked up and my husband is laughing. He's laying in bed watching me. And he says, "Come on to bed." And I started laughing, too, and he didn't ever leave me. But that company never did have a mixed party until after my husband died, because they couldn't insult him by not including me. And, oh, crazy, crazy. I did a lot of other crazy things, just a lot of them. I'll just tell you maybe one or two of the things. After my husband died, I would think if I was in one area that it would be better, and my family came and brought me as far as Missouri, where two of my brothers lived. They gave me a job, and I went a few days and then would leave at noontime and not go back. You know how it goes. And I actually possibly never put in 2 full weeks the whole time that I had an office there. And I met a man while I was drunk. He wanted me to come to Connecticut to meet his family, and he wanted to marry me. He seemed gung-ho about it, and I didn't have anything else to do, so I went. And I didn't really know the man. I'd been drunk every time I'd seen him, you know. And he was drinking, too. But I didn't know what he was like, really. And I went there, and the family was very happy to meet me, apparently. I overheard his mother, who was deaf, said to one of the daughter-in-laws that she's a lovely Southern belle. I want to tell you, before I left there, the bells quit chiming. They quit celebrating my arrival about the second day, and I'm out of my whiskey to drink between drinks, between social drinks. I always carried a bottle to drink between social drinks. And they were the kind of family that the whole family drank if it was something important. And they celebrated, and they quit like that. You and I can't do that. Kill us. We know we'll die. I've been close to it many times. You know, if when it got cut off and I was cut off from the source. But anyhow, they left us alone one afternoon, and I have no more to drink during the daytime and between social drinks. And the family's gone, and we were watching, not watching, we were listening to a baseball game over a radio. And I said to Carl, "Carl, let's have a drink. I'm dying. I know I'm going to die if I don't get a drink. I haven't had one since early morning." And several then, you know, two or three. And he looked at his watch and said it was too early. I never heard such a ridiculous statement. And then he said, "And besides, we don't want to drink alone." I didn't even care whether he drank with me. And I started asking him a lot of questions to see what we had in common. And the only thing I ended up with was all we had in common was baseball. And I knew the season was too short. So I went in and called a cab, and I went 13 miles away out there in Connecticut Hills and got two bottles, one to take back and offer them drinks out of it, and the other one for me to drink by myself. And do you know that man took that bottle away from me? Mm-hmm. And I picked up a full Coke bottle with the cap still on it, and he saw me pick it up, and I aimed it at his head, but he had time to pick a chair up. And it busted the chair, and his dear little mother was standing right there by him. That's when I asked him to take me to New York. I got to New York. I was registered in two hotels and staying at another one part of the time. I know it sounds crazy, and I'm also in Knickerbocker Hospital, alcoholic wing, which was, they moved the old town's hospital there. And then I find myself sitting across the table from a man, and he said, "We better hurry," looked at his watch, and I asked him, "What was the hurry?" And he said, "We don't want to miss our plane. I don't know where we're going." And so just stalling for time, I said, "Can't we take a later one?" Said, "No, it'd make us late in Miami to get out of a marriage certificate." And folks, I give you my word of honor, I remembered where I met him, but I didn't remember the woman's name that introduced us. And I looked at him, and I studied his features carefully, and I couldn't recall his name. I never have been able to recall his name. And I said, "You're right. I've got a lot of packing to do. Maybe I better run to the bathroom, come back and finish the champagne, and then get a cab and run ahead of you and start packing." And I went in the bathroom, and I found out that this restaurant opened onto another street, too, and that I didn't have to go back through that room to get to the the other outside. And I hailed a cab, and I asked him, I said, "I don't care where we go, as far away from here as you can, but just don't go in the river." And that was the way condition I was in. Now, folks, I would believe that all of this was hallucinations except for the fact we talked to Alabama and talked to a lovely lady, and she knew his family. And she told me that it would be a good marriage, that they were Episcopalians, first settlers in Florida, and they owned a high-rise on Miami Beach, and that she thought that it'd be a good marriage. I didn't have the fortitude to ask this lovely lady who was the man that she talked to that I was going to marry. She died before I could get honest with people and tell these kind of things, you know. Anytime my family asks me what happened, anybody asks me what happened, about both men that I was going to marry, I'd prefer not discussing it. I think when you don't remember, you better just say that and not try to. And, my family found me. The Waldorf Astoria called and said I owed them over $1,000 and that I said that I couldn't pay them. And my brother said, why'd you call me? And said, because she said she represented your company. He straightened them out real quick that I didn't represent him or his company anywhere. And he said, what she said you wouldn't believe it. She said when she was able, she'd draw her name to a check. And when she got ready, she would have a maid come up and pack her, and she'd go home. And if she could find the key to the vault, she eventually would cover that check. She'd sell something and cover that check, and said, I won't tell you the words she said we could do if we didn't like it. And she's still here, he said. And that I was. But my brother finally got somebody to put me on a plane, and the only way they could get me on the plane out of the wheelchair was to carry a bottle on the plane ahead of me, and I followed it. And then my brother, I was met out on the field at the airport by my nephew, and he was to take me to the office of my brothers, and they said they would go have me declared incapable of managing my own affairs. And I thought they meant financial affairs, and when I told them about what the setup was there, they said they couldn't manage those. But what they really meant was my whole life, and they would go have to have me declared incapable. And that would have been a mental charge, because you couldn't put alcoholics in Camarilla and state hospitals then, except under a mental charge. And I knew they didn't want to do it, but I knew that they couldn't stand to see what was happening to me. And to make a long story short, they told me they didn't want me in the homes, didn't want the children to see me, that the children seemingly knew that I was sick and not bad, and let's keep it that way. And that's what we did. And except that I had to have breast surgery, and my family rallied around me with love and money. They thought I was going to die of a malignancy, and I knew God wasn't going to let me die of anything so respectable. That he was going to make me live and suffer, and that's what happened. It wasn't malignant. But so my brother came again after they had gotten me specialists, and they had been so good to me, and he came over and released me with love after talking to these Al-Anons. He really released me with love. He told me that he had talked to the police, and he had told them not to take me home again, just treat me like any common wino, put me in jail, and he told me not to spend my nickel calling him because he wasn't going to bail me out. And he told them not to go after my whiskey for me anymore and not to loan me the money when I couldn't sign a check. The police sort of did those things for me. I always tried to stay in with the police, even in New York, when I was so high on the street that I was afraid that I might fall walking across one of those wide streets. I've been up to policemen and say, sir, I'm sick, would you help me across the street? And you know, I'd run to them first and say, oh, thank God you're here. Thank God you're here, I need you, I am so sick. And they never examined the possibility I might be so drunk because I had told them I was sick. You know, or maybe they knew and just took care of me, I don't know. But the people thought they were helping, but you know that people that love me damn near killed me, including my husband way, way back. And so what happened was that he told me that they definitely didn't ever want me in their home when I was drinking again. And my brother told me he thought he was saying goodbye to me forever, that he didn't believe that I could stop drinking, that he didn't believe I wanted to stop drinking, and that he thought he was saying goodbye. And they had had me for dinner that night. When I went home, I could not stand. I had been without whiskey for 3 weeks, so I wasn't in a need of it, physical need of it. But I could not stand the apartment. I could not stand to be alone with my thoughts. I just couldn't take it. And I called and ordered a case of whiskey, and I wasn't expecting company. And I didn't call for any help. I just simply drank. And I guess it was for nearly a week. They counted, I can't remember exactly. They counted the bottles. They figured however long it was, that I drank two fifths a day. They saw no signs of my having eaten anything. Nobody knew if I called them. I didn't call anybody I knew in this town. And finally, they got worried about me, and a woman from AA came over and took me home with her. And people like you came and took care of me. And I remember seeing your faces and seeing something in your faces that I wanted, and in your eyes and your countenance. And I kept all night long trying to think, as they had to give me whiskey to keep me alive and stuff. I kept trying to think, what is it? I now know that it was peace of mind, serenity, human dignity, and purpose in living. And I knew that I had that at one time in my life, and that I had looked like you looked at one time in your life. And folks, I wanted it more than I ever wanted anything before in my life. And so the next morning, when Earl and his wife, who was, we had very few alcoholic women, they came over, and I said, Earl, I want to stop drinking, but I'm scared I'm going to die this time, Earl. And he said, I understand, Alabama. You're a very, very sick woman. We've been trying to find a place to put you. And there weren't places to take women in those days, except in big cities that they could have gotten me in what we call dries. And there wasn't any place, and the local hospital wouldn't take me because I had caused nothing but trouble when I was drinking and coming off of whiskey. I had been in it a number of times, and I gave them real trouble. And they couldn't fly me out to New York or to California or any place because the planes were not running because of these horrible snowstorms. And they found they called a man named Walt in Independence, Missouri. Now, Walt kind of, for free, directed a little hospital. All of this is in quote. It was back of something that looked sort of like the Nest. I haven't been to the new one, but to just sort of give you the idea, the club rooms look sort of like that, and then back of it was some rooms. And they would take their fellow brothers in there and detoxify them, but they didn't have any room for alcoholic women. And they didn't have any alcoholic women to detoxify them. So, but he talked Walt into taking me. And they drove me up in a snowstorm when they were stopped by the highway patrolman and told to travel at their own risk. And the men came down and got me and carried me up the steps. And I learned later there were 12 steps to recovery there. But I didn't know it at the time. They took me head first up those steps. And I saw people like you that came in to help Walt take care of me. But they couldn't help take care of me because I went insane. And it was frightening to them. And the doctor told them that the adrenaline was pumping so that I could kill a man twice my size. And Walt said he wasn't afraid of me, that he had been just like me trying to kill himself in jail when the doctor and some men from AA took him out of jail, the judge allowed them to, and took him to the doctor's basement, and they took care of him. And he said, I'll stay with Alabama. If you will come over, Dr. Nason, and treat her, because this doctor here in town doesn't know what to do. And Dr. Nason drove in this inclement weather after he'd been at the hospital and so forth in his office all day. He drove early in the morning and late in the evening over to take care of me, because there was not a doctor in the town of Independence that knew what to do for me. They were afraid that I would die of a heart attack with the adrenaline pumping so, and if I didn't, that I would go totally insane and be a vegetable. The doctor said that he had never seen any woman, alcoholic, as sick as I was, that didn't have one of the two things happen to them. And he said very few men have lived through it. Now this I found out all of it later, you understand. And Walt stayed with me 5 days and nights. And if you've never tried to stay with an insane woman 5 days and nights, it takes something far more than I have. And I believe that it wasn't physical, but I believe it was the spiritual strength that Walt had that made it possible for him to stay with a babbling idiot that could kill him. And at the end of 5 days, Walt told me the prognosis was not good, that the doctor said there was nothing further that medical science could do. And Walt said, I've done everything that I know to do. And he said, there's one thing that you might do, but I can't tell you for sure that it worked. It worked for me, that's all I can tell you. And I said, what? And he said, I've been praying that God would restore you to sanity and remove the obsession for you to drink on a lifetime basis, a day at a time. And he said, I prayed it aloud. And he said, your family's prayed for you. Their churches have prayed for you. AA groups that don't even know you are praying for you. And he said, could you pretend that God is polite and that he doesn't come where he's uninvited by the host? And I said, yes, I could pretend. And he said, could you ask God to restore you to sanity and remove the obsession for you to drink on a lifetime basis, a day at a time? I said, Walt, I can't remember that much. And he said, I know. He said, could you ask God to let you mean what you're going to repeat word for word after me? And I said, yes. And I asked God, and I repeated it after Walt. And in a dirty bathroom that 12 men and I were using, in this dirty bathroom, I heard God say to me, don't be frightened, if you'd been there, you wouldn't have heard a word. I heard God say to me that I could be sober and I could be saved on a lifetime basis, a day at a time. And I came out of there telling the people that I met in the hall what I heard, and they ran and got Walt and said, it's happened, Walt, it's happened. She is totally insane. Walt said, what's she saying? And they told him, and he said, on the contrary, this is the sanest she's ever been since I've known her. And it was the beginning of this new life for me. I stayed there. You people came and they tried to, everybody was great to me. They were marvelous to me. I hadn't slept in those 5 days. I finally went to sleep and slept like a baby for 8 hours. And for a little while after I awakened, I had an out-of-body experience, whatever you call it. The doctor said my heart stopped beating, and that actually for a few moments it wasn't beating, and Walt said that it was a spiritual awakening. And I said, well, what does it matter? It's all rebirth, isn't it? So it doesn't matter. And see, I'm very conscious that I had that, and I don't want to ever forget that that was another gift from God. I don't want to ever forget it. I don't care which it was, it still was a gift from God. And I don't want to ever forget that I'm here on borrowed time because it's God's pleasure for me to be here. And it kind of bothered me at first because I knew I must have purpose in life, but I didn't know what that purpose was. And all I would say to me is that I'll just keep doing and trying what is before me to do until I find out what the purpose is. And what I saw before me was to try to help the new sick girl that would come into Independence there and get them to put one room for girls up there and go up there at night and stay with those girls. My sponsors made me go to work, and I didn't want to go to work, and they told my family not to give me any money for one solid year, and they knew my estate was tied up in court. And I asked them not to mention work to me because it grated on my ears. And they told me to go get a job, and I wasn't successful because I didn't look. That's the way, you know, you've seen people sitting in coffee rooms around and wonder why they don't have jobs. Well, I was gonna be one of them, but my sponsors wouldn't tolerate it. And so my sponsor got me a job and paying 76 cents an hour clerking in a store, and I bitched. And he told me I would pay them to teach me how to work. And he was right. And he told me I'd have to stay 2 years for to be any good. And he told me that I must give everything that I got away, you know, in AA, away to keep it. And that's that he said, you empty the vessel so you can fill it again. And the way, only way you can empty it is to give of yourself to others. And they taught me a little bit about self-honesty. I'll end with that in a minute. And they taught me about working and how to work and how to be of service to my customers and to the people that hired me. And at the end of 5 months of working and 7 months sobriety, I have been promoted to manage and buy for my department. And I've got babies that are sober, and one of them died sober, you know, I mean, not too many years ago. And everything's going good for me. My family likes me again, you know, and everybody in the family is speaking to me, just not sending money. And the boys are all so good to me there, and my sponsors have taught me to regain a little self-worth, and I took my fourth and fifth step. And I went down to the clubhouse one evening, and the boys waited for me, and they called it Alabama's meeting, and they told me, my family, they'd never let me go hungry. So they wanted to ask me if I'd had enough vegetables and proteins that day, and I'd give them the menu, and if I hadn't, they'd say, well, who's popping? Who's got enough money to take her out to eat? The rest of us will drink coffee. And they were just real great to me. But this one night, they said, well, come on over to the table. I said, I can't, boys. I've got to go upstairs to see the poor girl upstairs. They came in here at noon when I was down here. And I was wearing a halo because I'd just gotten my promotion. The girls, as I said, were staying sober that I was sponsoring. And a halo is most unbecoming to an alcoholic. They tarnish readily, and I think that is caused by the toxic poisoning from the alcohol. And they have a way of sliding down and blinding us. And in this condition, I went up to see the poor sick girl, as I called her. And I came downstairs, and I said, oh, boys, in a very sanctimonious, or so they told me later, voice, oh, boys, I'm so glad I didn't go the lengths to the poor girl upstairs went to, and shook my head as I was wont to do. And one of the boys with a sixth grade education, but smarter than I'll ever be, looked at me and he said, Alabama, what she done you ain't done? And I said, Dick, she told every one of us in this room today that she was a prostitute. I had to whisper it. I couldn't say the word. And Dick looked at me with those Al-Anon eyes and shook his head. And he said, Alabama, ain't you gonna ever get honest with yourself? And I looked at him and I said, Dick, I don't know what you mean. And he said, honest with yourself. And I said, I told you I don't know what you mean. He said, I believe you. He said, I mean self-honesty. Won't you ever be honest with yourself about what you were like? And I said, I still don't understand, Dick. And he said, don't you know the only difference in you and that gal upstairs is that you didn't know you could sell it, and besides, you didn't need the money. So every time I might think that I'm doing right well, I just have to remember how stupid I was, and have to remember Dick. I'll never forget him as long as I live. I'll never forget the people who love me enough to tell me the truth. I'll never forget the people who have allowed me to try to help them. And I'm very grateful to have been with you this evening and to be sober. And all of you have a good week. I'm going too.